I don't know where to start, but if we're going to talk about the CV, I have so much to say. Myra is the first Deputy General Secretary of the Baptist Union, first woman Deputy General Secretary of the Baptist Union. She's also worked for the World Council of Churches in one of the departments related to World AIDS, if I'm not mistaken. But one thing that really stood out, Myra is the instrument of God for making me a minister that you see me today. In the year 2003, I arrived in England and I was studying at London Theological Seminary, but I'm not really sure if that's the right kind of training that I have. And in 2008, I started thinking of going back to university, and I approached several colleges, and twice I was rejected. The third time, I received an email from Myra saying, let's try you out. So I visited the college at Regent's Park College in Oxford, had a conversation with her. And to tell you, that has been one of the most wonderful events in my life, because that was September 11 at that time. Some people, of course, I remember that that's one of the saddest day. But September 11 at the time, I was given a place after Myra put me through the panel of interviewers and had a bit of a conversation about that essay they asked me to write. But I'd like to point out that what stood out Myra, that the reason why I asked her to preach is that for 4 years that I studied at the university, every end of the term, I always said to Alma, honey, I can't do this anymore. It's too much. It's just too much. I can't handle this. And then without asking for any details, Myra would just ask me also to her office and says, how are you doing? And then I thought, are they talking to each other? That, you know, why they know that I'm really struggling? And she would say some kind of words that she probably may have not thought about it, but that really pushed me forward to continue with my studies. One outstanding thing is that when she realized that I'm struggling writing my long essay, she even offered her whole house where we could stay for 3 weeks when they left for a holiday so that I could focus on writing my essay. That's really, really kind of you, Myra. I've never forgotten that. But one thing that also I would say, the reason why I asked her to preach is that to highlight the fact that since the beginning of time that I looked into the ministry, I heard the first gospel from a woman Sunday school teacher. I was encouraged by a woman minister back in the Philippines to train for ministry. When I arrived here, I was adopted by an elderly lady in London. Then when I came to Oxford, Myra was there. She was also instrumental for me to find a place to stay in Oxford. And she was the one who inducted me, who ordained me in year 2017, because the guy did not come up, isn't it? So she was there. That's why I thought there should be a pattern. And I'd like to say to you that it's my greatest pleasure to introduce to you the woman of God who served God with all her heart. She's now retired, but she never stopped serving God. She never stopped serving God. And what you're going to hear from her is pretty sure that you would hear why I really want her to speak, because God speaks through her. Myra.
Thank you so much. Thank you. Dear friends, it's lovely to see you, lovely to be here. And I have to say thank you to Gerald for those very gracious words. I can echo something of the story that I could hear Rose giving earlier. Because when you walked into my office and the conversation just flowed, it felt right. It wasn't difficult to see that God was really calling you and that you had a journey to make. And it was my privilege, amongst other tutors, to journey with you at that time. So, thank you. Like you, Gerald, I have been browsing the website of the church and came upon the sermons. So I listened to Gerald preaching on the Transfiguration, and I became very tempted to have a kind of conversation with you. Those of you who know the sermon will remember that he asked the question, what happens when God reveals God's self to you? What happens? It's a very Gerald question. It's always action. What happened? So I'm going to recast that question sort of using Paul's language. When God reveals God's self to you, Paul would kind of ask the question, what does it mean to encounter the glory of God in the face of Jesus? What does it mean to encounter the face of God in the shining face of Jesus? And what does it mean, as Paul would say, to be transformed through the renewal of our mind? These are the questions that I think lay behind your question. What happens when God reveals God's self to us? But I'm not going to start with the Transfiguration story. I'm going to start with a passage from Isaiah, which is very much about the glory of God filling the earth and giving to the reader a great transcendent experience. In the year that King Uzziah died, I saw the Lord sitting on a throne, high and lofty, and the hem of the robe filled the temple. Seraphs were in attendance above him. Each had six wings. With two covered their faces, and with two they covered their feet, and with two they flew. And one called to another, saying, "Holy, holy, holy is the Lord of hosts. The whole earth is full of his glory." The glory of God could not be contained within the temple of worship. It spilled out into the whole of the nation. In the Old Testament, the glory of God is not hidden away in heaven, as we see in these sentences. The glory of God spills out through all the earth. Isaiah sees very vividly in his vision the holiness and the glory of God. The problem for Israel is not that God is absent. The problem is that they do not see God. They have forgotten to look for God. Isaiah, in this chapter, feels the weight of the burden. He feels the weight of the distance that has welled up between God's people and their Creator. The distance between God and a people who have become blind to his presence. And he takes that pain into himself. If you like, he personalizes it. There's a sense in which one of the burdens of ministry, Gerald, is that you will take into yourself many of the stories, many of the burdens that you hear. And you will, in that way, personalize it. You will carry the burden. You will share the burden. But it is important with the prophet not to take it so into oneself as to lose sight of the real cause, the real hope that Jeremiah was able to bring to the people, that there would be a new day and there will be a new chapter, and we have a God who stands with us in difficulties and struggles. So the fullness of God, the glory of God, comes close in Isaiah. But the fullness and the glory of God comes, can I say, even closer when we move into the New Testament. When the Word became flesh and we have seen his glory. Glory of God shining in the face of Jesus. And comes even closer again in the final weeks of his life. When
if you like, the story of Lent, which is what we are now journeying through, the story of Lent is framed by two episodes, both of which take place on mountains. Two mountains bookend the passion story of Jesus. One mountain, probably Mount Tabor, is the Mount of Transfiguration. It's radiant, it's overwhelming, it's unmistakable. The other mountain, perhaps not so high, certainly not as high as Tabor, but nevertheless called Mount Calvary, the place of crucifixion. Not radiant, but dark. Not overwhelming, but tense and violent. And unmistakably a place of sorrow and defeat. Both of these mountain experiences reveal the glory of God, but they do so in completely different ways, and we need both perspectives. I think you know the story of the Transfiguration, so I won't go back and read it, but I will turn to that story now. However, I come to you today via 3 days in Paris, which is very enjoyable, I have to say. It's a beautiful city. You will recall, I expect, in 2021, a fire broke out in the ancient cathedral of Notre Dame. For seven centuries, that great cathedral had stood tall and proud, pointing upwards to the heavens, reminding a nation that was more and more secular, here is your God. Seven centuries, it withstood violence, wars, famine, all of that. Seven centuries. But here, now, in 48 hours, it was a ruin. A heap, a mangled, charred wreck. And this happened before the eyes of the world, as the media brought a story which left so many people totally aghast. It took 170 years to build that cathedral. Many generations filled it with their gifts of craftsmanship and prayer. 170 years. In just 4 years, thanks to amazing technology and science and craftsmanship, the cathedral was once again reopened. What struck me as I stood during this last week in the midst of that great, beautiful cathedral, what struck me was the stones are the same. The structure has been rebuilt exactly. The interior was exactly the same, and yet it felt different. How? It was different because light suddenly has been allowed to absolutely invade every little corner of the cathedral. Details that were once hidden in the shadows have been revealed with stark and striking clarity. The building has not been made into something different. Its former glory has been revealed in ever greater beauty. The light that now shines in is disclosing what was always there, but was only dimly seen. That, my friends, I began to feel as I looked around, that is a picture of transfiguration. It's breathtaking. On the mountain, Jesus does not become something different when surrounded and covered in a blaze of light. The glory that was always there was unveiled in a new way. For a moment, even a fleeting moment, the disciples that had gone up the mountain with him were given a sight of Jesus which had before then been hidden to them. They were able to see the glory of God in the face of Jesus in a new way. But, and this is what the Gospels and Mark, which I'm referring to in particular, what the Gospel writer makes very clear is that seeing, in Gospel terms, is not the same as understanding. Often we will say, I see something. I see some cars passing over there. It's a very physical comment. The physical sight of cars, I can see, no problem. But of course, there are other times when we go, ah, I see. It's a completely different meaning. Now we've gone deep. Now we've done a deep dive and started to see beneath the surface and behind the superficial into a depth. The disciples witness the physical light. They hear a voice. They fall to the ground in awe. Yet, Mark tells us, when they descend the mountain, they are completely confused. Yes, they saw, and they were wowed. They had a real mountaintop experience. But they came away not much wiser. They hadn't really seen in the way that says, now I understand. The problem was not that the disciples failed to see. The problem was that there was, if I used the language of the clinical world, there was cognitive dissonance. It didn't fit together because their idea of glory and how they wanted to see Jesus and how they saw God was about power and might and brightness and brilliance, nothing flawed, nothing stained, everything pristine. This was their vision of goodness and purity. They could not reconcile this picture of glory, which was at least reinforced to some degree on the mountaintop. They couldn't reconcile that with the glory of God, which Jesus had presented to them just 6 days earlier. When Jesus had said to them, in response to their recognizing, yeah, you really are the one who is to come. He said, yes, and as the one who is to come, you need to know that in my glorified state, I will be humbled and reduced and humiliated. I will suffer and I will die. This just didn't add up. And what we begin to see, I think, in the big picture that Mark is giving us, is that Mount Tabor and Mount Calvary are doing two different things for us. We need Mount Tabor's glory. We need the high points, the mountaintop experiences. And it would be good to believe that today is one of those mini mountaintop experiences when the joy, the excitement, the anticipation of a new ministry and a new chapter is right in our midst. This is good, energizing mountaintop stuff. And we need it. But we can't live on it all the time. We also need what Calvary offered, a glimpse of glory that is veiled, where we see in weakness and in suffering and in apparent defeat the glory of God. What shines in brilliance on one mountain is embedded and enacted in sacrificial love on the other. It was not until Christ's death and resurrection that Peter and the others began to understand. And I want to suggest today that their journey from Tabor to Calvary, their discipleship journey from transfiguration to crucifixion to resurrection to transformation, is a journey of faithful discipleship that is constantly repeated in our own individual lives. Maybe every year in Lent, maybe in our personal devotions, but it is by making the journey through these different key moments that our own personal understanding of what it means to be transformed into the likeness of Christ can really come about. The same pattern, the same journey was there for the Apostle Paul. A blinding light on the road to Damascus reduces him to the floor. A voice from heaven tells him that he is persecuting. And in that moment, not on a mountain, but on a road, he is on the journey of transformation. But it doesn't stop there. That is only the beginning. Later in life, Paul is very honest with the churches that he planted. He's honest about the struggles he had, honest about the fact that coming to understand God's power, not simply in strength, but in human frailty, was a bit mind-boggling. It was foolishness to the Jews and the Gentiles, and to the human standard of understanding, frailty is hardly a glorious state. But he writes, as his parting words to the churches in the early centuries, "We all, beholding the glory of the Lord, are being transformed from glory to glory." And the reason and the only way we can do that is by living not only in the brilliance of the transfiguration, but in the shadow of the crucifixion. Because who we meet is the same Jesus in different guise, the same God glorified, but in utterly different ways. I think we have a wonderful story in the life and the biography of John Newton, which reflects what we see in Scripture. He was, of course, the writer of that famous hymn, "Amazing Grace." "I once was blind, but now I see." As a young man, John Newton was the captain of a slave ship. He was deeply involved in trafficking. One time on a transatlantic journey, a storm rose and he panicked. Having nothing ultimately before to do with God, he found himself crying out for mercy. And later in life, he looked back on that moment, on that night, and saw it as the beginning of his journey of conversion. It was a beginning. It was not a completion. Although he had his faith awakened in his mountaintop, he continued for a time still as a slave trader. It would be years later before the gospel persuaded him to reshape his moral vision. Slowly, painfully, he came to see that what he had once accepted as normal was utterly at odds with the love of Christ. Over time, then, he left the slave trade, became a pastor, and in humility, near the end of his life, he publicly spoke out against the very system he had once defended and profited from. "I once was blind, but having made the journey through the crucifixion and the resurrection, now I see. A gradual opening of the eyes to the depths of God's grace and the demands of God's love." So I pray that this day will be all of that in one. It will be a day where we continue to recognize there is clarity that there has not been, maybe in past months or years, a new clarity and a new excitement. Praise God. I pray that there will also be a recognition that in the weeks and months ahead, there will not only be joy and excitement and highs, there will be the need to travel together in the shadow of the cross, to see in the face of one another the suffering Christ, and to know in the suffering Christ there is resurrection. So may we journey this Lent and in this new chapter, you, Gerald, together, congregation, committed to the journey of faithful discipleship, knowing that the highs and the lows are both essential for the glory of God to be revealed in this place. Amen. Thank you.